The All opportunity came about unexpectedly, just after finishing an interview with Lawrence Monroe. He's the Rhino Operations Unit Manager and Zapwing Coordinator at Ezimvelo KZN Wildlife. Not only is he an expert ranger in the field of rhino conservation, but he also has a thorough intellectual understanding of conservation and protection strategies. He is further heavily involved in Project Rhino, which is a refreshing initiative seeking to streamline cooperation between the various private and governmental organizations that protect rhinos. At the time we met him in 2013, 18 conservation agencies were working together in the project to combat rhino poaching. Since getting involved with rhino conservation over the last few years, I've been amazed just how many organizations refuse to work together for fear of losing business, especially security companies in the private sector. Fervent backstabbing and bad-mouthing often prevent any progress across large sections of the country. Projects that seek to unify the country behind a single goal are few and far in between. While walking down the airstrip from where we were filming, Mondra received a call with the news every ranger has unfortunately come to expect. Not another one. His dejection was obvious. How old? From the context, I gathered that the carcass was about a day and a half old. It had been shot two nights early and was found by patrol over the weekend. The crime scene investigation team was going out first thing the next morning. Having hung up, Monroe immediately filled us in on the details. I decided to tentatively ask whether we might be allowed to join the team the next day to document the process. Monroe fell silent for a while as he considered. He has impressed all of us since we arrived in KwaZulu-Natal. An intellectual ranger, passionate about conservation, and above all, a man with honourable intentions. He has been one of the kindest and most articulate individuals I've come across during the whole project, and I could sense from his thoughtful silence that he sincerely wanted to help us. Jeff noted the other day that support of this kind has been a characteristic of our project, and it has been an humbling experience. Ever since I've embarked on this documentary, I've often felt like an outsider, an imposter in a world in which I'm regarded as uninformed simply by virtue of the fact that I don't live in South Africa any longer. Even people close to me questioned my persistent involvement with issues regarding South Africa, especially related to economics and general ethics. What is more, I'm a filmmaker and thus a member of that blasted band of people who, for the sake of a story, always meddle in the business of the real men and women making a difference on the ground. Honesty compels me not to argue with such an opinion of my profession. Many filmmakers are insincere, chasing after sensation, money, and the latest topical fad. Filmmakers do, in fact, take away the time and attention of people who are actively working to prevent disasters, crime, and injustices. We can be annoying, very demanding, and only involved in the issue as long as the production process and budget last. As soon as the final shot has been filmed, we can leave a location polluted or destroyed while forgetting that the subjects of our films involve the actual pain and suffering of real people. Equally, though, we can be guilty of none of those things, instead harboring a deep desire to raise awareness, affect the world positively, and make a difference in the lives of people. In fact, most filmmakers I know, including myself, are desperately trying to weave something good out of the chaotic mayhem we call our contemporary global society. However, I cannot help but also see these same issues reflected in an environment that I've walked into with this film. It is a deeply suspicious world full of intrigue, hatred, racism, self-promotion, greed, corruption, frustrating ignorance, and mindless destruction. Yet at the same time, I've marvelled at the sincerity of good-natured and hard-working individuals seeking at personal cost to make a difference to a situation that seems almost hopeless. Within their world and mine, there are good men and women to be found in the midst of a whole lot of badness. "There is one thing I could try," this good man said while dialing a number on his phone. "I can't promise anything, but it's worth a shot." For the next 10 minutes, Monroe explained to one of his colleagues who we were, what we do, and that after spending the last 3 days with us, he couldn't see a reason why we should not be trusted. He fell silent again as his colleague talked to a third person on the other end of the line. Then suddenly he perked up again. I could hear his colleague returning the conversation to Monroe. Looking at me, Monroe then inquired, "Can you agree not to reveal the location?" "Of course." "Are you okay with not filming any faces?" "Done." "Can you pay for another filming permit?" I paused. "But then, if I must." Nodding understandingly, he returned to relay my acceptance of the terms. The next morning at 6 a.m., I found myself signing yet another filming permit on the hood of a car. The amount due is 4,750 rand. And although I knew there was nothing to be done, it annoyed me nevertheless that I'm required to pay so much money each time we film in a national park, especially as an independent filmmaker. Every free speech bone in my body rebelled. But hey, I thought, it's for conservation, remember? Or so I was told. We were still waiting for another person to join us. So while we waited, I decided to stroll away from the car a bit. Looking around, I sank my hands deep into my pockets. The August air can be rather biting, yet in a matter of hours I knew I'd long for the cold. The humidity would challenge my every movement without mercy. I became aware of my breath, clouding up and trailing off like my thoughts. I only met Dr. Ian Play a few days ago in Elspruit. His connection to this area must be why I thought of him then. This emblem of rhino conservation was entering the final years of his life, and still he agreed to see me for an interview. Despite the obvious frailty of his body, his mind was as sharp as ever, and his passion for conservation unequivocal. At one point, he described to me a story he must have told 1,000 times by then, the moment he saw his first rhino. It was in this area in 1952 that he saw them, I thought. I had just arrived in Umfolozi Game Reserve, and it was one of those misty, overcast, slightly drizzled days. And out of the bush came these rhinos, and there was steam coming off them. There were hundreds of flies buzzing around them. The ancient prehistoric creature clearly made a dramatic impact on me. I knew that my life somehow will be associated with them. I just had that intuitive feeling, and indeed it turned out to be. His voice trailed off a bit as I saw tears forming in his eyes. "Yeah," he sighed heavily. "I had to fight very hard, but with great willingness, because they are wonderful, innocent beasts, absolutely innocent. The white rhino is non-aggressive, the black rhino can be aggressive, but the white rhino not at all. You can clap your hands at them, they'll run away." "That is very true," I thought. "David and I have been 10 meters away from a wild white rhino recently. I was nervous at first because we were completely on our own without any form of protection. But it only stared back at us, annoyed that we blocked its way to wherever it was going. They really don't stand a chance if that's the way they behave.